I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Tortoise. Hello, welcome to Trendy from Tortoise. I'm John Curtis.
And I'm Rachel Wolfe. This week, we're going to talk about the monarchy.
It's been almost a year since the coronation of King Charles III, and now we've all been glad to hear that he's back to doing some of his public duties following his cancer diagnosis. So we thought this would be an opportune moment to take some time to look at the underlying trends which shape our attitudes towards the monarchy.
With that in mind, we're going to look at some new data published just this week by the British Social Attitudes Survey, and then look at how attitudes towards the royal family are shaped by the shifts in marriage, the decline of religion, the state of the family, and the views of the Commonwealth.
Well, British social attitudes, which I have some responsibility for, has been tracking on a regular basis now how people respond when they say, how important or unimportant do you think it is for Britain to continue to have a monarchy? So, Rachel, I think it's crucial we should acknowledge this is not about monarchy versus republic. It's about how people feel about the monarchy as an institution. Well, on the latest reading, we now have only just over half of people, 54%, saying they think it's very or quite important for Britain to have a monarchy. That actually is the lowest that British Social Attitudes has registered since it first asked the question back in 1983, but it's been regularly doing so since the mid-1990s. And 25% of people say, doesn't matter at all, or actually be quite happy to abolish it. So these figures are not dramatically different from the ones that we've been getting in a fairly regular basis over the last 4 or 5 years, but certainly we can hardly argue that the monarchy is an unpopular institution. But shall we say it seems to be more a subject of debate and consideration than it necessarily has been in the past. Indeed, if you go back to when British Social Attitudes first asked back in 1983, 86% of people said it was important to have the monarchy.
So, John, what do you think is driving this decline, and how consistent has that decline been since the early 1980s?
Well, the first thing that we should say is that, you know, it's a curious thing about polling, of course, is that you don't necessarily bother to ask people about a subject if there isn't any debate about it. And I can't actually tell you from polling evidence what people thought about the monarchy in 1952 or 1953 when Queen Elizabeth II first came on the throne. The first reading that I am aware of, and I'm really, really grateful to the Market Research Society's archive, which has lots of ancient polling data. It was done just after a film that I have to admit, Rachel, I'm old enough to remember. It aired on the BBC in 1969. It was called Royal Family, and it was on a Sunday evening, so the whole nation watched. And it was this is very much the programme whereby the idea that of presenting the monarchy as a family, and in a sense, It was part of Queen Elizabeth trying to modernise the monarchy and say, well, look, you know, we're not this remote body of people that, you know, are out of touch. We're a family like everybody else. Although, ironically, of course, they were doing this at a time when, shall we say, family breakup was beginning to go much more broadly on society's agenda. Anyway, immediately after that, NOP did ask people whether they thought the monarchy was good for Britain. 88% said that it was. And then, as I say, you then have to go to 1983, BSA, 86% saying it's important, or indeed Ipsos in 1984, 77% thought the country would be worse off if we have a monarchy. So there really wasn't much argument about it at all. That said, of course, the idea of a happy family didn't necessarily survive the test of time.
Did you say it was 1969?
1969 was,
which was the year of the Divorce Reform Act.
Indeed, exactly.
Which is interesting, which led to a very big spike in divorce because it made it much easier for people to dissolve their marriage.
Indeed. So in a sense, the monarchy embraced the family at the moment when the family, as we once knew it, as a relatively stable institution, was going to become less unstable, or at least it's going to be more a question of families forming and reforming with different personnel. But, you know, for the monarchy, this really was opening up the monarchy to greater public scrutiny, view, etc. But of course, a few years later, in the 1990s, more than one of Elizabeth's children found their marriage coming to an end.
So most listeners who are younger than John or even me will have some sense of Princess Diana, who was one of the most famous divorces in history. But Queen Elizabeth had four children and there was more than one breakup.
Yes, because Princess Anne broke up with her husband and Captain Mark Phillips, and then subsequently remarried. And of course, Andrew, who is more recently, to whom we will return later, divorced his wife, although they still remain on very good terms. So three of her children, more or less at the same time, the early 1990s, saw their marriages break up. But at the same time, the institution of the monarchy itself also began to be open to criticism, particularly the question of the amount of tax that the monarchy was paying became a subject of dispute. And in the end, John Major, the then prime minister, did do a deal with the monarchy whereby they started paying more. But then secondly, also towards the end of what the Queen herself famously dubbed Annus Horribilis, or for those of you who are not Latin scholars, horrible year. Towards the end of 1992, when all this controversy was going on, Windsor Castle suffered a devastating fire and people were saying, hang on, who's going to pay for this? And we did see support for the monarchy fall away quite markedly. So, for example, Ipsos, who again have regularly been asking people, do you think the country would be better or worse off without the monarchy? Beginning of 1991, we still had 56% of people saying we'd be worse off. By the end of 1992, it was down to 37%. When British Social Attitudes revisited the issue, rather than there being 86% of people saying that it was important to have the monarchy, the figure was down to 66% in 1994. And it was still the case that not that many people said they wanted a republic, but, you know, it was almost one in five by this point. So beginning to be something, at least, of a minority issue that people back. So the issue of marriage, therefore, and the royal family became something important. And I guess, you know, given where we are now at, Rachel, I mean, this perhaps is a moment for us to pause and think about, well, the royal family and marriage and society. And I suppose, you know, the first obvious point to make is that what subsequently happened to Elizabeth's children, including not least to King Charles himself, you know, is part of what has happened more broadly in society. Given where we're now at as society, I mean, one thought that's really struck me as thinking about this podcast is, well, these days, suggesting that somebody's partner comes with the person who's doing the job, it's become a bit of a no-no. For For example, to take another fairly high-profile establishment institution, people who are heads of Oxford and Cambridge colleges, there's no expectation anymore that the partner will necessarily provide the social oil and helping to socialise with students. Yet we still have this situation whereby if somebody becomes king, or indeed, frankly, Prince of Wales, there is still an expectation that their partner also effectively has a role. And I guess one interesting question to ask is, how long will that survive?
Well, I think there are lots of questions about how the monarchy can survive. But I guess one way to think about it is the monarchy considered a job? Or is it considered a representation in some form of the country as a whole? And if you think it's the former, it is indeed rather strange to think that Princess Catherine, the Princess of Wales, for example, should be expected to work as part of the royal family and she should go and earn her own living. We shouldn't pay for her.
She should have the freedom, like as we've been talking about in many of these podcasts, that many other women have taken
to pursue
their own career.
Well, it's not, of course, pure freedom because we do fund this family. We should come back to that slightly strange arrangement in a bit. Or, which is, I think, what you were saying, Queen Elizabeth intensified, but has always been partly how we think about the royal family. You know, for centuries, we've been poring over their personal lives in whatever the equivalent of gossip columns were. They are a family we are invested in and we consider to be representing us as a country.
Yes, and I think you're right. I mean, there clearly are at least two fundamental roles for the monarchy. One is, as it were, almost to help to provide social glue and social representation for the country. But I think one has to say that it's very much these days, the royal family also emphasised the extent to which this is a job, stroke, a duty. To that extent, at least perhaps a realisation that in order to continue to justify the funding that you just talked about, which has been a degree of controversy, they do need to portray it as an occupation. Now, of course, again, one could also ask, okay, it's true now, and you know, I'm an example of this. We're all being encouraged to work later in life, but are we also really being realistic? Was it necessarily fair to Queen Elizabeth for us to be expecting her to continue to be working well into her 80s? And, you know, should we be thinking about, well, at least at the age of 80 or 85 or whenever somebody feels that perhaps they've done their duty, that we should not necessarily regard abdication as necessarily something that should be off the agenda? Again, thinking about how we treat people in our society, yes, do the job for as long as you can do it, but do we necessarily be expecting them to do it until death's door beckons?
So, John, I feel like you've brought up quite a large number of very interesting trends. Maybe we should try and unpack each of them a bit in turn before we move to the modern day and what might happen in the future. So the first thing that struck me as you were talking, as we discussed a bit, was the life of the royal family has tracked to some degree the changing shape of marriage and relationships in Britain. Prince Harry, obviously, much later was interested because he married a woman who was not only not aristocratic, but not white. Before that, Prince William was relatively unusual as the heir to the throne and marrying someone who was not aristocratic, who was middle class, although quite wealthy middle class. Mm-hmm. And the Queen's children divorced at a much greater rate than even the country as a whole. So I thought that was interesting. Another thing that struck me, though, when you were talking about that TV programme about the royal family was that the monarch has been communicating through a period where we've moved from all of us watching the same programmes, all of us watching the Queen's Christmas message, all of us aligning culturally around these single events, to the much more atomised and fragmented media and consumption landscape we have today.
Which means King Charles's coronation did not have the same kind of impact on the country that the Queen Elizabeth did, of course, which occurred at the time at the advent of television, undoubtedly did.
And everyone of your age, John, has a story of the, or older, has a story of the coronation. You know, my mother will talk about the family who had a TV, because this was relatively rare at that point, and everyone used to sort of come and watch the coronation in black and white. And now it's not a universal event because we don't have universal events.
I should say, by the way, Rachel,
I was born. I checked myself as I was saying it.
I was born very slightly after the coronation.
I apologize, John.
No, not at all. That's fine. Just for the record.
So we have become less universal in what we cling to, and that makes a institution and a family that is designed to represent the whole country and communicate to the whole country more complicated. And to the extent that we attach any virtue to marriage anymore, and that is, of course, also declining, it's also an institution that has seen more than its fair share of messiness personally. Those are two very, very big trends. One other thing you talked about, though, was value for money. And we've seen these ups and downs in the royal family's reputation as much through money as personal behaviour. And the royal family has a very strange arrangement with the British government because it is not formally liable to pay any tax at all. There
Correct.
Is this voluntary, quote-unquote, agreement where it chooses to pay money to the British government. It's one of the many ways in which there is this strange relationship between the democratically elected government and the monarch, who has no real power but presents power. The King's Speech is another good example of that, where the King reads out, we discussed King's Speeches last year, reads out the bills of his government, mm-hmm. of which he's had absolutely no say or involvement whatsoever. And yet it is his legislation, his money, which he chooses to give to the government. And both sides accept that and don't want to test it because it would result in probably the collapse of the entire institution. But it's rather unusual.
But yeah, sure. I mean, it's been a source of controversy before. And clearly, if the monarchy becomes even less popular than it is at the moment, and as I said earlier, we still can't say it's unpopular, it's just now the subject of debate. But of course, there are a couple of other changes, Rachel, which have also happened over time, which arguably have also, made the monarch's role as a social representative of the country more difficult, and where perhaps the story of Harry and Meghan had a particular resonance. And that, of course, has become a much more diverse society. We've become a much more diverse society in terms of religion, including the fact that, many people now, if not most people, don't adhere to any religion. But also, as we've talked about previously, we now have a quite substantial minority Muslim population, as well as Hindu, Jewish, etc. And certainly, and of course, one of the potential problems for the monarchy until Harry married Meghan, potentially a woman of colour, was, it was this white institution. And of course, because it's about inheritance, was this institution ever going to be able to change to match the more diverse character of the country? Well, certainly one of the things one needs to bear in mind, poll done by YouGov in April of last year, asking people of black and minority ethnic backgrounds, 38% said they favoured the monarchy, 39% favour head of state. Now, given in the same poll, 62% of Britons in general supported the monarchy, you can see that for our minority population, the monarchy doesn't necessarily look like an institution that can represent them socially. And of course, the other thing that's now debated, although Charles did talk about this before he became king, he is defender of the faith, that is, the defender of the Protestant faith. And he did talk about saying, well, maybe I ought to be defender of the faith. Well, in the end, that didn't happen. And he is still the supreme governor of the Church of England. But, again, for a society which is now predominantly a secular society, again, one can see how coming down the track there is the prospect of, again, another social function, as it were, of the monarchy with respect to representing the religion, at least of the largest part of the UK, that is also, potentially a subject of controversy now.
We've discussed many of these subjects before, and we talked about religion just before Christmas, one of my favourite episodes. But as a reminder for listeners, the percentage of the country that are now regular attendees at the Church of England is less than 2% of the population.
Indeed.
We are now very substantially secular, as well as very substantially other religions. And so the king's position as head of the Church of England, itself a rather unusual international phenomenon because of our own history with the Reformation, is much more difficult to sustain when it's not the nation's religion.
Indeed. Anyway, having raised those difficulties for the monarchy, perhaps we should also acknowledge one of the ways in which it potentially does have power. One of the things that governments of all political persuasions often talk about the UK is that we do well in the soft power stakes. Now, that's partly because a lot of people who are running other countries have spent time here as part of their educational journey. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, for example, is a classic example of this. And you know that it's argued helped to ensure that people perhaps understand this country better than some others and feel relatively well disposed towards it. But the other thing, of course, is that the Crown can be used to basically embark on diplomatic missions. So it was interesting, for example, that the first royal tour that was arranged for King Charles after he became king was not actually to a Commonwealth country, which you might have imagined, and we'll come to the Commonwealth later, but rather to both France and Germany, seemingly part of an effort by the UK government to improve relationships with major European powers post-Brexit, although in the end, the French had to postpone the trip because they were having problems with civil insurrection at the time. But perhaps the biggest coup, and certainly the use of diplomatic power, which actually seems to have benefited the monarchy in terms of its public image, occurred in 2011-2012, when there were a couple of major trips taken by the Queen, one to the north of Ireland and another to the south. Now, of course, you know, relationships with the South has, long been difficult because, you know, it used to be part of the United Kingdom, left in the wake of the First World War and a civil war, etc., etc. So that was important. The monarch was actually seen to be in Dublin and, accepting the, as it were, Ireland as a separate state. But even more importantly, when she went to Northern Ireland, she shook the hand of Martin McGuinness, who, of course, was allegedly a former member of the IRA, also allegedly blown up Lord Mountbatten, relative of the Queen. So this was regarded as a big symbolic moment, helping to reinforce the devolution settlement that Northern Ireland now enjoys. And certainly, for example, again, just take British Socialist as an example, but it's there in Ipsos's data as well. All of a sudden, the proportion of people who said it was important to have the monarchy shot back up to around three quarters, up from around the two thirds that had been beforehand. Here was, I think, seemingly an example whereby when the monarchy was seen to be doing a good job, something that people thought was valuable, good relationships with the Republic, helping to cement the divide in Northern Ireland, then actually that could help to enhance his reputation in the eyes of the public.
I think the monarchy is a very good example of the trend versus individuals question. So we've been talking about the big forces that have shifted and made life complex for the monarchy. Changes in marriage, changes in relationships between men and women in the workplace, changes in how we get our news and information, decline of religion. Then there is also the question about how specific individuals and family members in the monarchy change that perception.
Indeed.
The actions of Queen Elizabeth at various points may have bolstered the popularity of the monarchy. Equally, the actions of individuals such as Prince Andrew might force it to decline.
Indeed. And certainly, Prince Andrew's fatal interview with Emily Maitlis, it's part of the background to why support for the monarchy is now back down to the levels we talked about at the beginning, together with, of course, I think the falling out with Harry and Meghan.
And so one of my questions, John, which I asked you earlier, but I was surprised by your answer, was do the great royal weddings, which seem to give people around the world quite a lot of happiness and interest, have any impact visibly on their popularity? And I think your answer was no.
Well, I mean, of course, these things can sometimes be difficult to work out from the timeline of the data. But the honest truth seems to be that the answer to that question does seem to be no. It's the work of the monarchy that matters. And indeed, more broadly, I mean, I think that there is indeed often a disjuncture. Well, there isn't necessarily a correspondence between the popularity of individual members of the royal family and the popularity of the institution. And I think this is particularly clear in the case of Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth remained highly popular all the way through to her eventual death in 2022. However, the truth is that by the time she left this mortal coil, the institution was as weak as it had ever been in terms of public support. And I think, therefore, to that extent, at least, the ability of, you know, coronations or marriages to make a difference, you know, should not be arrested. But indeed, I think, although, you know, King Charles's reputation, I think personal reputation, is now somewhat stronger than it was before he ascended to the throne, because he'd been quite often a controversial character as the Prince of Wales. You know, the reading from British Social Attitudes, another reading from YouGov recently, which suggests that support for the monarchy was down to 45%. It's not clear that, although perhaps he personally has had quite a good first 12 months since being crowned, that this has actually necessarily filtered through to the popularity of the institution.
And this may be another example, therefore, where trends win.
Indeed. We talked a little bit about Ireland. I mean, the other domestic challenge that the institution faces is beyond England. It is the constitutional debate in Scotland, as well as, of course, the continuing constitutional debate in Northern Ireland. And, you know, lots of polling in Scotland shows, first of all, that people in Scotland are much less likely to back the monarchy than are those in south of the border.
You live in such a contrary country, John.
I do, but it's what makes it fascinating for those of us who have the joy of commentating rather than the joy of trying to run the place. But for example, I mean, last spring, YouGov, 46% wanted the monarchy, 40% wanted a republic. Similar poll was 60% of people across the UK as a whole wanting a monarchy. And of course, what's certainly true is that people in Scotland who say they would vote yes for independence, a majority of them are actually in favour of having a republic.
Is that because they see the monarchy as a barrier to independence, or because the sorts of people who want independence in Scotland are also the sorts of people who have no truck with the monarchy?
Well, I think the answer to is that although, of course, the lineage of the crown is one whereby James VI of Scotland became the James I of England at the beginning of the 17th century, it's regarded as a British institution north of the border. And to that extent, at least, I think it's probably not true that people are in favour of independence because they dislike the monarchy, as opposed to they're not keen on the monarchy because they're in favour of independence and they regard the monarchy as a symbol of the union, right? That's probably the way around it works. But again, equally, it won't surprise you to hear, again, Lord Ashcroft did some polling on this recently, Northern Ireland split virtually 50-50 between monarchy and republic, but it's deeply embedded within the unionist-nationalist divide. Nationalists in Northern Ireland are in favour of a republic. Of course, they want to be part of the Irish Republic. Unionists very much want to hang on to the crown. So it becomes very difficult in Scotland and Northern Ireland for the monarchy to avoid getting embroiled in controversy occasionally. And of course, there was that famous incident during the 2014 Scottish independence referendum when the Queen, on her way to church on a Sunday morning shortly before the referendum, said that she hoped that people would consider carefully how they were going to vote, which was taken as a coded message that she was hoping that they would vote to stay in the union. And certainly,
it seems quite neutral to me to say that.
It was a very diplomatic way of saying it.
You read anything.
But shall we say it was widely known? I mean, you know, she spent a lot of time in Scotland. She indeed died in Scotland. And she was thought to, you know, feel very strongly about the value of the union between England and Scotland. But it's not necessarily reciprocated amongst all of her subjects north of the border.
I had one other question before we move to the Commonwealth, because, mm-hmm. of course, England and Scotland are only two of the countries that our monarch presides over, which is, we talked a lot about the extent to which people think the monarchy is important or not, or support the monarchy or not. But how much sense do we have of the intensity of that opinion? Because I remember in the wake of Princess Diana, endless, intense discussions about republicanism. There were lots of things on the BBC about it. People voluntarily talked about it. This may be my bubble, but I can't remember the time that I was present for an intense discussion on the in principle value of the monarchy. So is this something people say when asked, but they don't deeply care about it? Or do we not know?
I mean, I think the honest answer, we don't know. If you were to ask me to guess, I suspect that much of the support for the monarchy is what I would call banal support. That's not unimportant. It means basically it's what's there. It's the default. Of course, that's the way we run the country. Whereas those who are in favour of changing the status quo, who are undoubtedly still a minority, probably representing at least recent polling consistently around a quarter of the population, because they are, as it were, wanting to break from the status quo, you've kind of needed to have thought about it a bit and perhaps feel, perhaps therefore, somewhat more intensely. But that, I have to admit, is a guess on my part. I mean, I think, and I put it slightly like this, the monarchy needs to keep at working and persuading the public of the of its legitimacy as an institution. It cannot take it for granted, given not least, as we've talked about, the social and political changes that it's now having to negotiate as compared with the past. And
I think why, along with a sense of duty, a man in his 70s who's just recovering from cancer has gone back to work.
Indeed. And of course, I think the other thing we've not said, and we should say, you know, there is also a substantial age divide in attitudes towards the monarchy. Younger people are less keen than older people. Now, the truth is actually almost undoubtedly, until recently at least, that's what we would call in the trade a life cycle effect. It seems as though once people got older, perhaps because the monarchy was part of the furniture of their lives, they became keener on it. But more recently, there's been some indication that perhaps the level of support for the monarchy amongst the latest young generation is particularly low. Now, we'll have to wait and see how that pans out. Maybe the latest generation of people is a group of people who are above all particularly need to be persuaded about the merits of the monarchy. Indeed, only around 1 in 8 of them at the moment say, you know, it's really important to have the institution.
In a moment, we'll discuss the monarchy in the Commonwealth. First, though, a short break.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
So, John, let's finish by moving out of the UK and looking at the monarch's role in the Commonwealth. And you have some polling from Lord Ashcroft, I think.
Yes. So it's already the case that there aren't that many Commonwealth countries that still have the UK king as the head of state. It's 15, including the UK itself, out of the 56 Commonwealth countries. And there are around 20 countries, including Ireland, that at one stage had the UK monarch, which have decided to change their mind. So basically, it's the three so-called traditionally white Commonwealth countries, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. There was then still some of the Caribbean, Jamaica, Antigua, the Bahamas, and then there's some other very much less well-known, smaller island communities in the Pacific and the Caribbean. But it is now down to 15. Some of them are now due to have referendums in the wake of the accession of King Charles, Jamaica, Bahamas and Antigua. And basically, the headline from Lord Ashcroft's polling is that of the 14 non-UK countries, basically half of them look as though if there were a referendum today, they might vote for a republic rather than monarchy. That certainly includes Canada. It might include Australia, although there it's closer. And of course, Australia did have a referendum back in 1999 and voted to keep the monarchy by 55% to 45%. Of the so-called white Commonwealth countries, only New Zealand still seems to be relatively securely in the UK camp. But those referendums in Jamaica, Bahamas and Antigua, well, if Lord Ashcroft is right, certainly in probably Jamaica and the Bahamas, maybe Antigua, they're going to vote to go. So the extent to which the monarchy is still going to be, in another 20 or 30 years, stretching all the way around the world is perhaps rather more in doubt than whether the monarchy is still going to be here inside the UK in 20 or 30 years' time.
Which I suppose is another trend to finish on, which is that as the world changes, as countries become wealthier, as the centre of gravity for the world economy moves east, although most of the countries we've been talking about are west, it would be strange if a relatively small country in Northern Europe had quite the same institutional ownership over random parts of the globe in 30 to 50 years as it does today.
Indeed. But of course, Rachel, you've, as is your wont, have also been saying, well, but what about elsewhere? And of course, there are relatively progressive countries like Denmark and the Netherlands who also have a monarchy. And I think you've been digging out, well, how does our UK monarchy do as compared with their monarchies in the courts of public opinion?
Well, I've yet to find, John, the equivalent of the British Social Attitude Survey.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so.
Which I think you should go in and establish, because this lack of good longitudinal data has been a problem. But I think if you look at certainly Denmark and the Netherlands, which are our closest monarchies, Spain a little more complicated because of the kind of wake of the Franco period, you see something relatively similar to what we've been discussing, which is broadly high popularity for monarchs and for the royal family, but dented by exactly the same kinds of issues that we've been discussing. So we talked about money, but we also talked about the royal family behaving in a way that we want to see represent the country as a whole. And that's something we've seen play out in the Netherlands recently, where unlike Queen Elizabeth, who was scrupulous in her behaviour during COVID, most of us will remember the picture of her sitting alone at her husband's funeral, social distancing. The monarchy in the Netherlands has taken a very big battering because they were seen to behave more like Boris Johnson. One rule for us, one rule for everyone else.
It was you that said it, Rachel.
This, as with Boris Johnson, has had a major impact in their popularity. Nevertheless, I think similarly to here, it doesn't feel as though either the monarchies in Europe are in imminent risk of collapse.
But perhaps still need to keep on working at it.
But need to keep on working at it. And our subject, because all of the trends we've talked about today, the decline of marriage, the decline of religion, although these other monarchies aren't tied to religions in the same way, the disappearance of a unified form of communication and dialogue impact these countries as much as they impact our own.
Indeed. So now, Rachel, this podcast is coming out on the day of the local elections, but we have things to tell our listeners about our coverage of the local elections next week.
Absolutely, John. If like us, if particularly like John, you're interested in the results of the local elections on May the 2nd and how they might fit into the longer term trends of British politics, and perhaps most interestingly, what they might tell us ahead of the general election, then you can join us for the first ever Trendy Live on Wednesday the 8th of May.
Yes, Tortoise are taking the risk of putting Rachel and I before an audience. And we'll be recording that week's podcast in front of them in the Tortoise newsroom. And we'll also be taking your questions. So to be there, crucial for your diary, go to tortoisemedia.com/book and get your ticket.
But for now, that's it for this episode of Trendy. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis.
I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous women of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy Now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.